down together.
Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:33 p.m. on Monday, February 14th, 2022. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Present today are Representative Thompson, Representative Lebon, Representative Carpenter, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. Today we will have a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Here to present are Deputy Commissioner Rob Carpenter and Dom Panone, Administrative Services Director. If you folks would like to come to the table, put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner, DOT and PF, and we have our commissioner online as well. If he could open with some opening remarks, would that be okay?
That would be great. Commissioner.
Hey, good afternoon, Co-Chair Merrick and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Ryan Anderson, and I'm the commissioner designee for the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I apologize I couldn't make it in person, but I did want to take this opportunity to thank the House Finance Committee for this opportunity to talk on three very important focus areas of DOT today. One being our FY 2023 governor's budget, another being the direct federal funding and COVID relief funding, and then, of course, the Alaska Marine Highway System budget overview. We have a great team online. We understand this is an important presentation for us. And so, you know, you'll see Deputy Commissioner Carpenter, our Administrative Service Director, Dom Panone. Online, we have our Deputy Commissioner John Bender for Aviation. Also, we have our Communications Director, Shannon McCarthy, our regional directors from all three regions, as well as our Facility Services Director available as well for any questions. So appreciate, again, this opportunity. There's been a lot going on at DOT over the past year, just since the holidays even, and I think I'm pretty proud of where the department's headed and how we've been performing over the past few months, we're committed to keeping that going. So with that, I'll just turn it back over to Deputy Commissioner Carpenter to proceed with the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. And I will note that tomorrow's House Finance meeting, we will be going over the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or the STIP, as well as the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, IIJA, also from the Department of Transportation. So if your questions are related to that, we will have more information coming tomorrow. Mr. Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that postponement till tomorrow. We'll have much more experts in the room for those questions tomorrow. Thank you. And with that, I will turn it over to Dom Panone for the we'll tag team this presentation a little bit. Thank you.
All right, for the record, Dom Panone, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So first thing I want to do today is acknowledge the committee's committee substitute for the budget bill, kind of swapping the federal dollars. And just note that we'll be talking about the governor's budget as proposed, which is where our expertise is and what we can speak to are on. But do want to acknowledge the committee substitute. So we'll be giving a high-level overview of the fiscal year 2023 budget. We'll be talking about the impacts of the direct federal dollars within our budget, and then talking about the Alaska Marine Highway System in general and the budget as well. So slide three here. For a high-level overview, the fiscal year 2023 budget is a decrease of $76 million, $76.9 million, and a decrease of $60.4 million of UGF. There's no service-level reductions in our H&As or any of our programs. We continue to use the federal COVID relief funds to displace UGF or in place of UGF in our rural airport system specifically. The Marine Highway System sees a significant service level increase. We have several slides on that. We do use the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law Bill Funds, or EJA. They are one and the same in the AMHS. But as far as all other EJA and bill impacts, we'll talk about that tomorrow, as mentioned previously. We'll go to the next slide, slide four. So this is a graphic history of our budget by fund type: unrestricted general funds, designated general funds, other federal relief funding, and the EJA. And so this is comparing final authorized amounts in our budget. So that would include any supplementals we received that year, and then the current year, and then the proposed budget. And so going through the fund types, with unrestricted general funds, the trend you see there is at the beginning of this is a reduction in UGF in the Marine Highway System. And then going into about 2022, the current year, and into 2023, a reduction of UGF again in the Marine Highway System completely, and also replacing UGF funds with those COVID relief funds. So at the top, you'll see the federal relief funding in the dark orange, and then the lighter orange represents the newer EJA and bill funding in the ferry system. And you see a significant spike in the 2022 authority amounts, and that's because 2022 contained two significant items. It was forward funding for the Marine Highway System, an extra 6 months of authority, and the transfer of the public building fund and leasing components from DOA into our division of facilities to complete that consolidation. We'll move to the next slide, slide five. All right, on slide five, this is comparing the current year's 2022 management plan, that's our current budget scenario, with the 2023 governor's proposed budget. And we're highlighting here the $64 million of AMHS one-time forward funding, and then the $135 million of federal funding in the AMHS budget on the second side there. So that largely replaces $61 million of UGF in the AMHS budget. So that accounts for that 45% reduction in UGF.
Thank you, Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. About the federal funding for the Marine Highway System, is that a known number, or is there still to be determined exactly how much will be available for the Fed?
Through the Chair, Representative Laban. So the federal funding for the Marine Highway System is a new program that has $200 million available annually nationwide. And so that program hasn't been established yet. We're anticipating a notice of funding opportunity in spring that will have all the details of that program. But we have made a calculation that Alaska would get a significant amount of that available funding. And we programmed the amount of federal funding that we would need to run a full schedule, to run all of our ships really at maximum capacity. So it was a combination of the calculation of how much we'll receive and what it would take to run a full schedule, and that amounts for the amount of funding there.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess if it falls short, then you would find funding within the agency to make up the difference, to make sure that your targeted funding is realized?
Through the Chair, Representative Laban. So we do have some slides on the ferry system that coming up.
Okay.
We can discuss that.
Representative Josephson.
Through the Chair, for Mr. Pannone, the FY22 management plan, so does this mean that the department in the remaining months of the current fiscal year is sort of reaching back and hoping to use federal dollars and then supplant others and send those forward? So the administration is asking for an adjustment to FY22 as funded? Is that what that means?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson. So we're not asking for any adjustment to fiscal year 2022. On this slide, it's just provided as a comparison between the current year's budget and governor's proposed.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to clarify, I thought, what I heard. So you said that the feds have a new program, about $200 million annually nationwide, and you expect a significant amount of that would come to Alaska, and that's how you got to your $135 million, is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So the $200 million program is specifically, in the way the federal legislation was worded, is for providing rural ferry service. And to be eligible for that program, you would have to provide a ferry service to two rural communities at a population of 50,000 or less that are at least 50 sailing miles apart. We looked at over 197 ferry systems and analyzed that, and still to date, meeting that strict criteria is the Alaska Marine Highway System. So we would expect a significant portion of that funding.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up on that. So that 135 is coming from that 200 million, or is it broke out a different way?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct. It would be coming from the 200 million.
Okay. Just one, thank you. One more follow-up. You said new program, so does that mean this isn't just a one-time part of the infrastructure package? Is this actually a change in, you know, ongoing program that this, you anticipate this being like a yearly program that goes on in perpetuity or until something changes?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, this program is a five-year program as specified in the EJA.
Yes, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to add to that, what Dom said, this one thing we're trying to, I guess, get across, this is a new highway act for us, for the nation, and these highway acts are often amended or continued, and so we're hopeful this is an ongoing program beyond 5 years. We don't know that, of course, but these acts tend to, you know, re-up themselves with new things versus things going away. So we're hopeful this is an ongoing program.
Seeing no further questions, please continue.
All right, for the record, Dom Pannone, Department of Transportation. So this slide is showing a funding level comparison for our results delivery units. Those are the main breakout of our operating budget. Some highlights of the budget, we are taking a reduction of approximately $400,000 as we've realized some savings through the Department of Administration's Office of Information Technology. We are moving between two of these RDUs, $3.9 million of our DOT specific IT staff, that's our line of business IT staff, moving between design and engineering back to the admin division. We have a reduction of federal funding reversals of $20.3 million. In the current year's budget, there was about $20 million of COVID relief funds that were passed through for Fairbanks, IFA, and rural transit entities that was placed in the commissioner's office. That was one-time funding through COVID relief funds, so that's being backed out. We're also reducing about $11.5 million of duplicate authority for Division of Facility Services as we've combined the Public Building Fund and leasing. We no longer need that authority. And AMHS service increase, we don't have any budgetary layups built into that. That's an increase of approximately $23 million. Questions? All right, slide seven here. So this is just it's called a Sankey diagram, and it shows the composition of our budget. If you're more visually inclined, the left column shows all of our fund sources. They flow into the second column, which is all the fund classifications, which flow into that green square, which is our overall operating budget. And then a breakout of our major expenditure lines. So $416 million in personal services, $207 million in contractual services, $76.9 million in commodities, and $5.9 million in travel. Any questions?
I see no questions. Is it possible to get some of these slides adjusted for the CS.5? I feel like we're looking at numbers that aren't really applicable at this point.
Madam Chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT. I'm sure we could do that. The totals definitely are the same. I think the only thing in the CS is that the federal funding was replaced with general funds. Is that correct? So conceptually, they're mostly the same, but I'm sure we could come up with the.
Nope, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, slide 8. So this slide is meant to give some context about our contractual services in our budget and the commodities lines in our budget, and comparisons to other departments. So Department of Transportation is highlighted here. You can see over $200 million is for contractual services, and almost $80 million is for commodities. So signs, road treatment chemicals, paint, things like that. And this is to highlight the exposure to market forces within our budget that we have to manage against for fiscal constraints. So things like inflation or CPI increases. Okay, moving to slide 9, and this slide is highlighting our the amount of personal services or budgeted to staff, over $400 million. There, and that's the largest for the department in the governor's budget. And so the graphs on the right are to highlight a significant increase in overtime for our winter months this year, with that bright blue line showing our current trajectory on the top. And so our belief is that given the significant number of winter events that has driven that up, and then coupled with the amount of vacancies, which requires more overtime to deliver our standard service level, we're seeing a significant increase in overtime. And those graphs just represent our equipment operators, so the people on the streets. Okay, slide 10 showing a history of our vacant positions department-wide over the last 2 years, reported by month. This does not include the Alaska Marine Highway System, and we'll talk about that when we get to the Marine Highway System. And across the top there, there's department-wide equipment operators. DFS LTC is the Division of Facility Services, Labor, Trades, and Crafts. So those are the people working on our buildings when the boiler breaks or there's a roof issue or something like that. SEF is the Statewide Equipment Fleet. So that's the folks working on a broken down plow or making sure that our equipment can run when there is a weather event. So those vacancies have a cascading effect into other operations within the state. Okay, and the bottom row there, the highlighted rows are most recent numbers. So department-wide, 389 vacancies, 114 vacant equipment operators, 27 facility maintenance type positions, and then 18 vacant positions in our equipment fleet division.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm okay if I ask questions as we go along?
You certainly are welcome.
Okay, thank you. So I wanted to ask a couple questions about your workforce, in the sense that do you have any idea of the comparison of wages across the country to ours at all? Or where I'm trying to go with this is to get a sense of where our workforce might be vulnerable as there's all the variety of infrastructure money coming and people maybe moving elsewhere or moving in. But these are the kind of positions that are skilled people that obviously are in demand, as well as having a vacancy. So first of all, I guess my question is, how do we compare?
Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner DOT, through the Chair. Representative Johnson, it's a great question. You can see on this chart here the rising concern that we have as an agency. It's felt through, as Dom said, our equipment operators, our mechanics, just everywhere, even in the Marine Highway System. And we're doing some preliminary analysis on the wage differentials, and we're very actually concerned about the amount of money coming, and it's not just our agency, it's the private industry as well. There's going to be a competition for labor, no doubt, and there's a concern maybe we can't compete. I know other unions, the 302, Local 71, they're looking at the same thing. The contractors are concerned. We've had conversations with AGC that they're going to have a lot of money and a lot of contracts and not have the people to do it, especially even competing down south. So it's going to be interesting how this plays out. It's certainly something we're very concerned about, and we're looking at for our agency alone and making sure that our program can get delivered.
Follow up? I guess I'll just ask this on the record, and hopefully, I know we have a lot of business before us, but as you continue with your analysis, but I think it's going to be probably administration-wide as far as the concern of some of these issues, I guess I would ask that maybe this committee could have an overview on our workforce and our comparatively how we're doing, and even perhaps some of the what kind of level of additional hire we might need, or I guess that remains to be could be kind of figured out. But I just hear this concern over and over and over and over again, not just in here in the not just here, but private sector as well. But I think if we just kind of put it off and say we recognize it's a problem but don't start thinking about it, then we're going to find ourselves behind the curve. So, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Chair, just a couple questions. Looking at the numbers from, I'm assuming, January 2020 to July 2020, I'm wondering what was in place at that time over the six-month period to reduce the number of vacant positions. It looks like by about 60 roughly, bringing it to the lowest point in the last 2 years of vacancies. And then I guess the other question is if it's possible to get a trend or graph or whatever that shows maybe year over year for the last 5 years or a longer period of time than just 2 years, I think would be helpful in looking at everything overall.
Through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen, we can provide a longer look back, and I can't speak today to the steep drop off of vacant positions, but that occurred in the first year of the pandemic in the summer. I can't speak to that today, but we'll get back to you on that.
Thank you, Representative Edgman.
Yes, I just want to pick up on the line of questioning that Representative Johnson put forward, and I would hope at some point we do have some kind of hearing into that issue, because it's not just DOT, it's Department of Education, it's public safety, it's it's almost the entire realm of the statewide workforce that's in the public sector, and I can't imagine that this is just specifically an issue of compensation or retirement. It's bigger than that. But although I think it is related, but if I could, Madam Co-Chair, ask maybe the Deputy Commissioner, what do you think is generating this? Because these are fairly significant vacancy factors. And then as we go through this presentation, you can't help but wonder, we've got an onslaught of federal money coming into Alaska, a huge amount that's not factored in this presentation, not at least in some respects. But I guess to my question, Rob, why are we seeing vacancies like this out there? And I can't imagine that these vacancies are just going to go away.
R- Rob Carpenter, DOT, through the chair, Representative Edgman. That great question, one that I think everyone across the nation is trying to figure out why there's not the workforce there was. There's definitely, within our agency, where we have some natural attrition going on and some difficulty recruiting. There seems to be, I don't know if it's a generational change too, as far as the interest in the work, or if it's our recruitment programs, our training programs aren't quite what they used to be. We're looking at it all, and we're trying to, you know, we recognize the problem. We're actually quite concerned about it, and but we're intending to deliver. You know, you'll see in a couple slides some of the things we're doing that have been effective. Like up on the Dalton Highway, we have a 2x2 schedule, which is 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off for the crew, and that was actually quite attractive to many of them when we implemented that during the early phases of COVID, because we wanted them to have less turnover and hopefully not infect as many people was the idea. And it actually was effective, and it provided additional overtime for them, which made, you know, they earn more money, and that was attractive. So there's obviously a wage thing there. And then we have, what's it called? Mission critical pay in certain areas we're trying to implement, where we're really having a hard time filling positions for, you know, like in Nome, I think is the example, and where we're close to closing an airport because we don't have anybody to, you know, open up the main or open up the runway. And so we try to put in a mission critical pay, but then that will kind of eat, and you know, people might come from other parts of the agency, and then we're, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. So you know, the socioeconomic reason why we don't have these people, I'm not entirely sure, but we're looking into it, and we're re-upping our recruitment efforts and our training efforts, and looking into everything we can. We're working with Department of Labor extensively to try and improve things. So we see it coming, we're concerned about it, and doing what we can, yeah.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, through the chair. Do you know if the state laws currently allow 17-year-olds to begin training for certain heavy equipment operating? I'm not quite sure how long it takes to get a CDL, for example, and the training, obviously. I don't know if it's something they could do the second semester of their high school senior year, or something outside of the box we could do that may need statutory change in another area of law for age constrictions.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I don't, but I think we have a few people online that might be able to answer that, or one of our regional directors, or one of our M&O chiefs, maybe Jason Sakalaskis.
I do not see Jason online.
Okay. How about Wolfgang Young?
Wolfgang Young, are you available? And did you hear Representative Rasmussen's question?
For the record, this is Wolfgang Young, DOT Central Region Director. Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes, the question is if laws currently allow 17-year-olds to begin training for some of the equipment operator positions, if there's any state statute that prohibits them from starting training at a younger age.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I'm not aware of any statutes that preclude commercial driver's license training and testing prior or at a certain age, but we can get more information from the commercial vehicles folks and get that back to you.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate you showing this data to us, and it's very concerning to me, as I'm sure it's concerning to the rest of us. I'm actually kind of surprised that you're showing the data this way without further explanation, because it doesn't tell us a whole lot other than there's a problem. I would like to see numbers of separations versus numbers of retirements along this graph. Vacancies by the trade, vacancies by the location throughout the state. Maybe vacancies per an assessment of what the organizational health of the culture is in those organizations. Mm.
to kind of give me an understanding of why we would be seeing such a large uptick, other than just it's happening. This to me tells me that there's some sort of a management problem, but it doesn't help me define what it is or what solutions the legislature should put in place to help solve it. So I hope that within a very short period of time, we can have a better understanding presented to us of what the data actually means, because it just means there's a problem right now, but I can't see what the problem is.
Thank you. Any comment on?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to comment. This was intended merely as a high-level overview of the issue. I bet Wolfgang Online could elaborate a little more as to the problem, because he's got a little more insight. If we could ask him that.
Mr. Young?
For the record, Wolfgang Young. Again, sorry, there's a delay on this end. Could you please repeat the question one more time?
No question.
I can restate it. Wolf, they're looking to understand the increasing rate of, our workforce trends and our vacancy rate. And I was hoping you could shed some light from your perspective.
Through the chair, certainly. This is Wolfgang Young again, for the record. A lot of our vacancies and our cyclic throughput on employees really began increasing since 2006. If you remember, 2006 was the breakpoint between Tier 3 and Tier 4 employees for the state of Alaska. So once the pension benefits disappeared and we became a contribution or matching-based employer, those benefits became transportable. So our ability to retain employees really much longer than 4 or 5 years anymore, and no more than 10 years, became largely impacted by the transportability of those benefits. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm staying on the same topic. Is there a regional impact? I mean, I'm certain there is. When you look at 114 equipment operators statewide, is there a pattern of regional impact that you can identify, or is it just broad and everybody's feeling the pain?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Lebon, absolutely. The rural areas are obviously more difficult to recruit. We've had some vacant positions in rural areas for quite a bit of time. And as I mentioned earlier, we've thrown mission or implemented mission critical pay in certain areas where we're finding it extremely hard to recruit and retain employees.
And as one quick follow-up, this number close to about 390 vacant positions, looking at the far end of the graph, what percentage does that represent of total positions?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, we can provide an exact number, but roughly 2,800 budgeted positions in DOT total, full-time positions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can you please define mission critical pay?
Madam Chair, if I could defer that to Wolfgang, it's basically an increase that we would work in an LOA to provide additional incentive to work.
I was just curious the calculation for that. Mr. Young?
For the record, Wolfgang Young, Central Region Director, and through the chair. Mission critical pay was an incentive pay that we devised in concurrence or collaboration with the unions for staffing at our remote locations. So an example would be Bethel Airport, one of our larger airports. We were struggling to keep those positions filled. We implemented tools such as the two-on, two-off program. We provide housing, free housing for those folks that go out there on that two-on, two-off. And we also introduced the mission critical pay, which is an additional financial bonus for those people occupying those positions. These are all tools that we've tried to use and come up with to attract a workforce out to these rural locations. And in large part, it's worked fairly well.
Thank you for that. This is Representative Merrick. Is there a formula for calculating the mission critical pay, or is it sort of arbitrary amounts?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, I'll get that formula to you, ma'am.
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much. We have questions from Representatives Ortiz and then Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative LeBond's line of questioning, the figure that you threw out, you said that that's in relationship to 2,800 full-time employees, and we're down 390. Does that number 2,800 include the Marine Highway system?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So looking at our budget, we have 3,393 positions budgeted, 2,964 full-time positions. So that does include the budgeted positions within the Marine Highway system. And on that budget, we have 794 budgeted positions for the Marine Highway system.
So I think I heard you say that the 2,800 then is not inclusive of the Marine Highway system. Is
yeah, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the total number of budgeted positions is roughly 3,400, oh. And that does include the roughly 800 Alaska Marine Highway systems. Those positions are not accounted for here, so it would be roughly 2,600. Would be the total number without AMHS in our budget.
Follow up. And because it clearly says at the bottom of this graph here that the vacant positions does not include the Marine Highway system, my question is, would that make the ratio of how many people roughly do we have that are, how many vacant positions do we have roughly in the Marine Highway system?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, so we do have a slide on the vacant positions dedicated just to the Marine Highway system, if we can answer that when we get
back. Thank you. We have Representatives Thompson, Rasmussen, and Josephson. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm just a little bit curious about looking into the future. We've got the infrastructure money coming from the federal government, Build Back Better, things like that that are going to, is it going to have an effect, and is there any way to project what's going to happen once that money hits and we have contractors bidding on jobs? Are they going to be able to take away more of our and stop more of our retention because contractors with union contracts that are trying to hire are going to raise that? Is that going to create a bigger problem into the future with this extra money hitting?
Madam Chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT. Representative Thompson, it's excellent. We're concerned about that. I mean, the private industry will need labor and a lot of it, and they will compete with us.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, in looking at overtime hours, obviously there's a direct correlation with the vacancy rates and the increase in overtime hours. Has the department determined where the room is? I mean, how much more could we go offer as an incentive across a lot of these vacant positions? What's the break-even point of how much we're spending on overtime basically at the current pay level versus higher pay to reduce overtime?
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, that interesting question. I don't know if we've done that analysis, but we'll get back to you.
Yes, Representative Rasmussen.
So I guess the other question is, has the department looked at putting some of these positions out to bid for contract work that the private sector could fill if we're unable to fill them at the state level?
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, we are certainly we contract now in many places, rural communities especially. And we are looking at, we had a renter event in Fairbanks where we had to do some contracting to backfill and supplement our vacancies. So yes, it's something we consider and implement when necessary. And I think Dom had something on the wage question.
Yeah, Dom Pannone, Department of Transportation, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So we do look at the break-even point or the cost analysis on overtime and do work with DOA and the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, who negotiate our labor contracts. So we do analyze that and work with them and do share that back and forth. And we are in the process of looking at these numbers now again as we're seeing these spikes.
I guess just a quick follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
More statement. It would be interesting to see, because it appears that the change in defined benefit to defined contribution in 2006 is a possible factor for retention, in looking at the overall compensation package, you know, for an employee versus a contractor, I would guess that we could pay contractors a bit more and still save money in the long run if we're able to find the level of contract people that we need. Because I'm guessing that the state doesn't offer benefits in retirement to contractors. I don't know, is that something that you guys negotiate, or is it usually just a strict one-time payment in the bid?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we can contract out services on an as-needed basis or a specified, sometimes it's an annual contract. For example, a lot of our rural airports, the MNO is contracted out, but maybe Director Young could speak to that. But we don't pay benefits to contractors. We negotiate a price for the service.
Mr. Young.
For the record, Wolfgang Young, Central Region Director. That is correct. I would tell you that over 80% of our rural airports are maintained by contractors at this point in time. Those contracts are really fee for services. There are no benefit packages associated with the contracts. It's a direct fee for service. Does that answer the question, Madam?
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Co-Chair. I guess what I'm looking for is, how much does the state have to pay, I guess, additionally to what we would pay for an employee? And, you know, I just want to see the overall picture. So is it going to save the money, or the save the state money in the long run, to be contracting some of these positions out, not have the overtime expenses incurred because it's contracted, and then we don't pay the benefit package, I guess, on contracts, if that makes sense? I'm trying to think of an outside-of-the-box solution here and how that impacts the state financially.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So in some cases, contracting doesn't work out for us. We can't get a contractor at a certain location, or it's always an analysis almost case by case. But perhaps what we can do is provide some comparisons back to the committee of some costs of contracted airports versus state force maintained airports.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. And I want to be fair to the Department of Environmental Conservation, but I'm using them as a parallel or analog. They, when they've been unable to fill positions, have canceled those positions and no longer asked for funding for them. I think this is particularly true in spill prevention response. Does your department, do you ever consider doing that? Just saying, well, I guess we just won't have so many vacant positions.
Madam Chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT. Representative Josephson, these are identified needs for the agency. We need these positions. These are vacant, and we need these equipment operators, these mechanics, and these folks to do the work for us. So. Certainly, we look at positions all the time. We have an extensive. This is a portion of our vacant positions, and we're often told that, you know, when we have a need that a newly identified need, we're told by OMB, for example, to look at your positions and determine, you know, if that's a higher need for you, then replace something else. But these would be positions that are in high demand and high need for us.
Yes, follow up.
Through the chair, you said that this is a portion of your vacancies. What is the missing portion?
Through the chair, Representative Justice, and we have the Marine Highway section we haven't spoken to, and then there's also
every other, and we have engineers, we have, I don't know, admin people, lots of other folks. But this is the primary concern area, is why we brought this forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, the department-wide column does represent all department vacancies except for the Alaska Marine Highway System. The other three columns are a subset of those, but not all-inclusive. Okay. Slide 11 here. So this is the purpose of showing that slide. Certainly, we have far deeper analysis, and we are doing an overview today, but was to kind of explain the increase in overtime and what these budget requests here, the two budget requests for mission critical incentive pay, $100,000 and $279,000. So we'll be providing the committee back the formula of how we handle that. We also, as within the department's control, we did establish the Dalton 2 week on, 2 week off, and it's an interesting statistic, this table here. It shows the maintenance districts there and the percent of unfilled positions, and you'll see the Dalton's down to 3%, while the others are, somewhere around 15 to 30. So we certainly see the increase in service and on in that district, and the satisfaction of employees certainly draws our talent pools into that district, even from our own talent pools. So that's a highly successful story for us, the amount of overtime and the increase in pay there. And of course, we do contracting, especially for extreme weather events, when our normal operations have an exceeding load put on them, and we'll talk about that. We can talk about that a bit more, I think, in a later slide. Okay. Slide 12. So this year or last year, we requested a reappropriation of funds for $1 million for emergency weather events. Those are the events that happen very late in the session or some other extreme weather event. It's a capital appropriation. And we're requesting another $4.6 million as a 2022 supplemental of reappropriated funds. And so what this does for us is it allows us to absorb those spikes in the unprecedented events that happen throughout the year without having to figure out where we cut services somewhere else to make the end of the year. It's sort of a supplemental, a pre-supplemental request so that we have a buffer. We can also then account for and explain where those funds went to the legislature as we request subsequent extreme weather appropriations. So again, the use of these funds are restricted to contained, defined events for costs above what is budgeted. They go through headquarters review and the budget section review. And because they're capital appropriations, we try to conserve the funds. So we limit use to absolute need within the regions so that we can have them carrying forward into the future and not have to ask for more going into the future. So we exercise fiscal constraint on those funds.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm sorry if I'm a little dense here, but why is this a capital appropriation?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, great question. So it's a capital appropriation, because we're reappropriating funds and we want the funds. It's a multi-year investment back into our infrastructure. So it meets the requirements, so over $25,000 multi-year benefit. And structurally allows us to retain that buffer and not expire at the end of the fiscal year.
Just a quick follow-up.
Let's follow up.
Can you expand, I guess, a little bit on what the $4.6 million, what infrastructure is that being reinvested in?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So on our next slide, if we can move to that, we could talk about what we would use that for. So this is a breakout of the 2021 supplemental. Earlier this year, we had a Sterling Highway landslide that was, of course, an unforeseen, unbudgeted amount, $110,000. We're using it for that. Fairbanks winter storm, which is, you know, cumulatively over $2 million of impact to our budget. We're using $890,000 from that first appropriation to cover those expenses, and they're lined out here. And then for the $4.6 million specifically, we'd be using it again for the Fairbanks winter storm, the Matsu winter storm, $158,000 of costs, mostly damages to lighting and other parts of our infrastructure. And then, you know, we would evaluate any other extreme weather events that happen this year.
Sorry, just one more quick follow-up. So it seems like there's kind of a mixture here with personnel of operating and capital, and I guess I'm just a little bit confused why it isn't broken out, just so we have a little bit more transparency and true budgeting for the public.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So great point. When we access these funds in our operating budget, those staff would be billing time to directly to the capital, so that would be an unbudgeted amount. So the funds are all there in the capital appropriation accounted for. So if we want to report back on what those funds were used for, all the costs are captured within there, and all the events would be reportable. So the appropriation is for, you know, these costs that we hadn't budgeted for that would otherwise be asking for a supplemental, and this is the appropriation they land on.
Thank you. Please continue. Pardon me, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to get off track here just a little bit, but back when I was mayor in the early 2000s, the city of Fairbanks, we do our own snow removal and everything. We hire through the unions. They're not under PERS or TERS. And when summer would get there, we would lay off most of our grader operators, and they would go to work for private contractors doing construction. State of Alaska keeps those grader operators on 12 months of the year, and they have something for them to do. A local fence contractor there in Fairbanks got a hold of me and said, you know, I have a contract to fix any of these fences that get tore down, and he said they've got six of their operators out there repairing a section of the fence where a car had gone off and taken it out. He said it took them 2 weeks with their six people out there working on it. He said, my company's got the contract, and I'd have two or three people go in there and get it fixed within 3 or 4 days. There seems to be a little bit of a hang-up on how do we manage our employees for the best use and for the least expense. I don't quite understand, and I don't know if that's been addressed at all, but it's something that kind of bothered me. It has bothered me for 15 years. I don't know if there's an answer to it, but it's something that, you know, why the heck do we have operators doing whatever they can to stay employed through the entire summer when they're not operating a grader 90% of the time?
Mr. Carpenter?
Madam Chair, Representative Thompson, interesting. I don't know that specific event, obviously. You know, full year-round employment's critical for maintaining and retaining people. I can't imagine we are have personnel out, I hope not anyway, doing useless work. So I don't, again, I can't speak to that, but interesting story, and we can try and follow up.
I would predict operators that are doing snow removal and whatnot in the winter could be running construction projects in the summer. Is that correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Our M&O guys and ladies they're not just running trucks. They're doing all kinds of stuff during the summer. They're brush cutting, you know, they're chip sealing our roads. There's all kinds of duties that they perform.
Thank you. Please continue.
All right, Dom Pannone, DOT. So moving into the impacts of federal funding in the operating budget, we'll again, be providing a high-level overview. So there's four main federal legislation that affects that, the CARES, CRISA, ARP or ARPA, and last is EJA or BIL. They're one and the same. We also do have traditional federal funding that was in our budget before 2020 in the COVID relief funds. So we want to highlight that too, so that so we have awareness that that's there. The department has three federal partners that we received the funds from. It's the FHWA, Federal Highway Administration, Federal Transit Administration, the FTA, and the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA.
Thank you. Let the record reflect at 2:26 p.m. we were joined by Co-Chair Foster.
Okay, so moving to slide 15. So this graphic's just meant to illustrate the COVID relief funds that we received directly, or the federal funds that we received directly, and how those are reflected or classified by legislative finance. All right, moving to slide 16. So this is specific to direct federal COVID relief funding. So again, funding that we received directly from our federal partners. This slide shows the timeline that these funds would be available for appropriation and expenditure, and also the remaining balances, if any, for those funds. And those balances would be post 2023, fiscal year 2023. So they'd be available for appropriation in 2024, and assuming that the governor's proposed budget was adopted.
Please continue.
All right, slide 17. This is a breakout, kind of a high-level accounting of all of the funds we received from all three federal partners. In bold at the top of the table is the amount we received from each federal partner. So, by each federal act. So, for the CARES Act, the department received $111 million. For CRISA, it was $224 million. And for ARPA, it was $87 million of direct federal funding. Underneath that is the main uses of each of that funding. And then by year, how that money was expended. And again, looking at proposed in FY 2023. Going across there, you'll see we have about roughly $18 million in our operating budget that is displacing UGF, so reducing the reliance on UGF this year. And the balances at the bottom are what would be available beyond 2023.
Please continue.
Okay, so this is showing the federal funds, the comparison between the current budget and the governor's proposed budget by the fund source. So the federal receipts in the left there, that doesn't change much. That's traditional federal funds that we've always had through agreements with Bureau of Land Management or the FAA to maintain their facilities. The EJA funding increase there is due to the Rural Ferry Service Program that was discussed earlier. The COVID relief funding is largely the same. We're still swapping out a significant amount of UGF in our rural aviation program. The FTA CRISA and FHWA CRISA, that was there largely as part of funding the ferry system this year and the forward funding of the ferry system. So it was a slight reduction in federal funds in 2023. Okay, and this is looking at a comparison by results delivery unit. So the admin and support, the reduction there is due to those one-time pass-through funds that were placed in the commissioner's office and granted to the IFA or Fairbanks or rural transit entities. Design and engineering, that reduction there is there was some Alaska Marine Highway funds that were swapped for federal dollars, and those are being swapped back because those federal dollars are no longer available. Highways, aviation, and facilities, that reduction there is because of the FHWA CRISA funds. We had swapped $17 million of UGF for M&O. Those funds are no longer available. So So that's the net reduction there. International airports, there's no change. The Marine Highway System represents the change from FHWA and FTA over to the EJA funding. And then the agency unallocated was just applied to the previous funding by OMB.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, before we go headlong into the Marine Highway portion of the presentation, if someone were to ask me, well, I see you just had a hearing from the Department of Transportation at the House Finance Committee. What's the department doing in anticipation or preparation for all this federal money coming? Are they ramping things up? Are they hiring more staff? Are they, is there strategic planning going behind the scenes? Are they anticipating that they're going to have more operational expenses or more funds, this, that, and the other? What would I tell them? Because, and I don't mean to be critical at all, I think this presentation has gone along very well, but I'm just not seeing any of that in this presentation.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman. So there, the infrastructure bill is largely for capital and will largely impact our surface transportation improvement plan, which we're going to be speaking about tomorrow. So I think we will see and share a lot more information about that tomorrow. The only place directly in the operating budget that those funds impact is the Alaska Marine Highway System in the governor's proposed budget. But we can certainly go into the impact tomorrow, I think, if that's fair.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you. Rob Carpenter, DOT. Just to add on to that, Representative Edgman, yes is the answer. We're strategic planning behind the scenes. We're looking at our workforce and what we need to add. We have engineering needs. We have planning needs. We're certainly in the early stages of all of that. And not so much on the M&O side, but our aviation side and our capital program for surface is being analyzed as you speak.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, thank you. That's good clarification, and maybe I can hold my more detailed questions till tomorrow. But I just wanted, and I know a fair amount of people watch these hearings, you know, this committee and our counterpart down the hallway in the other body. But that's a question I think that's on the tip of a lot of people's tongues, given that your agency is the agency, the primary agency, almost exclusively the one agency that's going to be the beneficiary of all this federal money coming down the pike. And if that is an overstatement, please tell me so.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I'd say we are the most impacted for sure. And we are looking at all the different, there's new programs that are introduced in this bill. There's increases in existing programs, and we're certainly looking at every way we can, plan for it. We don't have all the guidance, obviously, on everything. We don't even have an appropriation for a lot of the programs yet because we're operating under a continuing resolution. But I believe our approach to this point was to have a presentation by the administration for an overall presentation of the take that was being approached on for the infrastructure bill. So those are starting to come out, and you will be more informed as we go here for the future.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT. So we're heading to the Marine Highway System, and this slide is, we wanted to just highlight some of the things that are happening with the Marine Highway System real quick. Since the Marine Highway Working Group was implemented 2 years ago, maybe, by the governor, so there were several recommendations that came out of that, and quite a few things we have underway already. The big one working with the legislature last year was forward funding the budget to where we could put out a schedule a full year in advance. That has been successful. We're seeing bookings for this summer that we probably wouldn't have received if we didn't have that schedule out. And so another big event has been that the Tustamina replacement vessel is finally ready to go to construction. We're working towards getting a contract out to put in place a CMGC contractor. That's a, construction management general contractor, I think is the acronym there. And that's a process. You folks were kind enough to pass a bill last year related to CMGC, which that process is where you, once you have the majority of design done on a project, you bring in a contractor to that will, in theory, work, do the construction component and do the final design, and hopefully avoid a lot of problems you would have had you not had a contractor on board to point out some things that maybe designers don't see. That's one of the primary benefits. So we're looking forward to getting that done on the Testamina replacement. And then a big another thing last year was getting the crew quarters appropriation. Thank you for that. That will allow the Hubbard, she'll be out of construction hopefully in October, and she will have, she'll be more versatile, which is something we need for the fleet right now, is versatility to, for when other ships are down for mechanical or whatever reason. Excuse me. Another highlight is we are working towards returning to Prince Rupert. The goal is for May 1st right now. We meeting biweekly with the Canadian government and the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol to work through all the necessary steps to provide that return service. We have it. We don't have it technically in our schedule at the moment, but we have a placeholder for the Matanuska to return to Prince Rupert. Once we are positive we can do that, we'll add that to the schedule. Another highlight is we're recruiting at this very moment for a Marine Highway Planner dedicated specifically to the Marine Highway System. This was, at one time we did have that, and that will assist in providing better planning for the system versus competing with the other planners in the state. We have implemented some private contract service to supplement some of our service this spring and winter when a ship is delayed in the shipyard and or other necessary needs. We've got a few contractors on board that can provide some catamaran service to some of the local villages and surrounding communities. We're very excited. We got the Taslina crewed up and sailing as of February 4th. That was, she's one of our brand new ships, and it's nice to get her back in service. That was a bit of a challenge with crewing, our crewing issues, which we'll discuss here in a few slides. And a big event that happened last Friday was the Marine Highway Operations Board met for the first time. That is, was a board created from HB 63 last year from Representative Stutes, and also a bill introduced by the governor and part of the working group recommendation. So that board met with the intent, obviously, to have a more business-minded focus for and addressing strategic planning, long-term planning, and short-term planning for the Marine Highway System to hopefully provide a different perspective for the agency to consider. And last but not least, one of the recommendations of the working group was a three-person team to sort of implement change at the Marine Highway System. We had determined we need to figure out what that change needs to be first, and we brought in a expert, I guess, in organizational change. Her name's Catherine Keith, and she's our new change management director, working for the commissioner's office and acts as a liaison to the Marine Highway Board and the Marine Highway System. And she's dived in head first from the beginning, and she's doing good things, so we're excited about that.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, a couple of quick, easy questions here. Who is the new chair of the MHOB board? And does the MTAB, the Marine Transportation Advisory Board, is that now going to a defunct status?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, thanks for the softballs. The new chair is Shirley Marcourt. She was voted as the new chair last Friday, and MTAB was repealed when this new board was put in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, thanks. Just wanted to get a high level. This is our FY21 actuals for the Marine Highway System and broke it out into a nice little pie chart showing the primary expenditures of the system. You can see that vessel operations, which is mostly staff, It makes up 75% of the costs. And then we have fuel, shore operations, and other things like reservations, marketing, and marine engineering, et cetera, just to kind of give an idea of how the budget is composed.
Please continue.
And this slide here, we wanted to show our actual revenue collections and how that the source of those revenue collections. So fiscal year 2021, we generated $27.9 million, which is significantly lower than we normally collect. This was a COVID year, and I would say we historically collect in the mid 45 to 50 million a year range, and we're hoping to return there. But you can see that 82% of our sales are generated from tickets, and then we have staterooms at 10%, passenger services, and a small amount of other.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. On a normal year, not a COVID year, are the stateroom sales, are those mostly occupied, or are there a lot of vacant rooms?
Madam Chair, depends on the route. Our long-haul routes, they're almost always full.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, now we wanted to get into our FY 2023 proposed budget that Dom mentioned earlier. The total budget's $141.7 million, of which it's composed of $135.9 million from the rural ferryboat program, federal money, and then a small amount of, as you see, a $5 million portion for designated general funds. This is the Marine Highway System revenue to pay for any ineligible costs or costs that we're not able to use the federal money on, like alcohol, food, things like that we resale. We put this little quip here, all ships all the time, just as a quick way to kind of summarize what we're proposing here. We have basically every ship we have running essentially full-time. There are no scheduled layups, budgetary layups cost-saving layups. There's no cost-saving layups built into the budget. So unless the ship is in overhaul or annual required overhaul, she would be running a schedule. We're not running ships on top of each other, but we're running them theoretically full-time.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you, Mr. Carpenter, if you can go back to the previous page, ticket sales make up 82% of operating revenues. Is there a breakdown as to passenger ticket sales versus vehicle ticket sales?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, great question. I don't have it in front of me. Matt McLaren online might be able to answer that one off the top of his head.
Mr. McLaren?
For the record, Matt McLaren, Business Development Manager for the Marine Highway System. Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, we can provide that breakdown. It is the majority of our ticket sales revenue is from vehicles on the car deck. So that's a bigger portion of that, but we can provide that exact breakdown for that fiscal year. We can get that to you.
And as a follow-up, ma'am?
Just follow-up.
In relationship to these resources moving forward and estimations as to revenue being stored up, et cetera, from ticket sales, are we moving forward with dynamic pricing, or is dynamic pricing going away in relationship to into these numbers here?
Madam Chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT, Representative Ortiz. We have dynamic pricing still in place. We have certainly heard from people that it's not exactly popular, so we're looking at it. I think the new board will be discussing our revenue structure and proceeding forward with that analysis.
And one final.
Yes, follow-up.
So going back to the next slide, number 23, the phrase, all the ships all the time, I understand that there's no layups due to budgeted shortfalls, but based on past 5 years of record of breakdowns, how breakdowns in the fleet, how likely are we really able, do you think we're going to be able to meet that all the ships all the time goal? How about that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'm not sure how to answer that. You're certainly bringing up a good point. We don't always meet our planned schedule. I know we had a slide, I don't know if we brought it with us, but there's a slide where we show our authorized budget versus our actual delivered weeks of service, and maybe we'll find it here in the next slide or two, but you're right.
Good enough now. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representatives Rasmussen, Laban, Thompson, and Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a couple questions. First, I didn't see anything about the Malaspina listed in any of the previous slides. I don't know if I'm missing it at the end, but is there a breakdown on the costs for that vessel currently?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we didn't include anything. Matt could address to what we're paying. I think we have a monthly fee of $30,000 for mooring, security, et cetera. You could add to that, Matt?
Mr. McLaren?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. Deputy Commissioner Carpenter is right. It depends. It is $30,000 to $35,000 a month, just depending on, you know, the time of year. We do pay utilities for it sitting there as well, so that cost varies a little bit. So, but $30,000 to $35,000 a month is the average.
Follow up. Has the department looked more at selling that vessel at this point?
Rob Carpenter, DOT, Madam Chair, and Representative Rasmussen, we are certainly evaluating that. We have been for quite a while. And that's all I can say to it at the moment. We're hopeful to have something completed soon.
Follow up.
I guess it's a thing today. I keep hearing a lot of very vague generalizations. It would be helpful for us to know a timeline, a more realistic timeline that we can expect. I do have constituents that reach out to me about these vessels, and it's nice for me to be able to report back to them. And my constituents don't really appreciate when I say, well, it's probably going to be soon, because that just doesn't help them understand any better. So could you guys get back to us with that?
Absolutely. I would just add that I wouldn't say we're in negotiations on anything, but, you know, there's sometimes things we just can't talk about, if you will.
Thank you. And then just one other question. I'm sorry, Madam.
Yes, Representative Rasmussen.
I guess it's two questions. So have we looked at contracting with a private company? I don't know if it's even allowed with labor negotiations, but it seems crazy that the state couldn't operate bars on the vessels. Can we contract that out to the private sector and split profits? And is it possible for the state to operate like pull tabs or some other thing on board that could be in concert with a nonprofit?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, I believe our collective bargaining agreements prohibit at the moment us contracting out the bar service. It's certainly something that could be negotiated with the unions. A lot of other businesses anyway contract that kind of service, food and alcohol, and I believe Washington State Ferries might have some of those services contracted. So we're in negotiation right now with all three unions, and I don't know if that's an item we brought forward, but it's certainly one that could be discussed. I'll just leave it at that.
I guess just to follow up on the, have you guys discussed like pull tabs or something with a nonprofit?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I'm not familiar with that, but floating casinos would be great.
Thank you.
I believe Representative Thompson has a comment.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I hate to go back in time again, but this is why I had my hand up originally. About 6 years ago is when they quit having bar service and the gift shops on the ferries. And we dug into that and said, why can't we bring in a vendor during the tourist season, especially when that money would be spent. And they said, well, we're losing $500,000 a year on these both of these things. And so we dug a little deeper and found out that the bartenders were being paid $100,000 a year, as were the operator for the gift shop. If they would be able to put that out, and we were forcing that and going after it, they said that's a union contract. We can't bring vendors onto the ships. So 1 year later, we looked and dug into the PCNs. Those bartenders and those people running the gift shops on the ships were still employed. They couldn't fire them because of union contract. They were all working on shore then and making the same amount of money. So this is something that I was been trying for years to get them to renegotiate those contracts. We talked to Alaska Brewing Company, and they said, hey, we roll 100 and some barrels of beer a year through there. A private bar would be making money. We don't understand why they can't make money. And if they could just do it during tourist season, it would be very profitable for a vendor to come on and do that. So I hope that they get this renegotiated and start looking at where they can actually make some money. And I agree with you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Thompson, was that your comment for?
Yes, that was it.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, follow up on Representative Rasmussen and Representative Thompson. Those were exactly my questions, the same, because it was a deja vu. We kind of beat this horse a year ago, or maybe even 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah, it's frustrating that we're not trying to think a way through, and I understand collective bargaining agreements. We have to find a way. I think back on a motorcycle trip about 15 years ago from Prince Rupert to Whittier, and both the bar and the gift shop were operating on the vessel I was on. And I mean, it's such an enhancement to the total experience. We need to find a way to do that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
About a year or two, I asked the question because they still have inventory of the whiskeys and wines in a warehouse right now. They have everything from the gift shops in a warehouse right now. And that last year that the gift shops were in operation, they had a lot of specialty items that tourists would want to buy about Alaska.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'd like to ask a number of sort of quick questions, if I might. On slide 23, this sort of funding of AMHS through the federal government is, this is unprecedented. Is that, we've never seen this sort of thing before, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, or Josephson, absolutely, this is the first time for this program.
And follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And IIJA expressly allows operating monies to be used in this way. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we believe so, that it's for operating rural ferries. And we think it can be used for capital, but we're still waiting for some guidance on that.
Again?
Yes, follow up.
These funds are not hung up waiting for Treasury guidance and that sort of thing. This is available in FY23, I assume. Is that right also? These are coming faster than other capital dollars.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, actually, they are a bit. There's a bit of a delay. We're expecting, as Dom said, a notice of a NOFO. What's that stand for? A notice of funding opportunity to be announced in April from the FTA, Federal Transit Administration, and we're from discussions we had recently with the FTA administrator. We're expecting a grant award in October-ish and receiving money little. Actual cash in December-ish. So one thing I will clarify is that this new bill, the infrastructure bill, is effective in federal fiscal year 2022. So there's $200 million for federal that fiscal year 2022 and 2023. So this money here is just 1 year's worth, and it could essentially be the 2022 money, and then we receive 4 years of funding after that.
And last question.
Yes, Representative Josephson.
So the long sort of agonizing struggle to fund AMHS although we still have service issues, for sure, is over, because this is ample funding, I take it, until, say, 2026 or 27. Is that right? In which case, at which time we go back to having an unsustainable source of funding. Is that a fair?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, unknown. We're hopeful that the program is permanent. Like we mentioned earlier, this is part of the Transportation Act, which, the congressional delegation worked hard to get this money primarily targeted at Alaska. We don't see a lot of competition for it. So we expect to receive the majority of it every year for the next 5 years and hopefully beyond that. It does provide opportunities for the Marine Highway System to save revenue, and I think that there's been discussion that we are proposing an idea of some kind of, I don't know if it's the endowment's the word, but some kind of savings account of our revenue to use in a future planning efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. So just real quick, this is, I need my glasses. This is comparing our budget proposal to the authorized budget the last few years. At the top line there, planned weeks of service, it gives an idea of the budgeted planned weeks of service and where the governor's budget falls. You can see that we're at roughly 362 weeks of service proposed and 6,300 port calls, and that lines up roughly with the FY19 level of service, so we're returning to levels back in FY19 roughly. Projected revenue is on the net third line down, showing $51 million in 2019, and fast forwarding now, you can see that we're hopeful for $53 million in the governor's proposed budget in 2023. And again, these are authorized levels, the actuals for the years, especially 2020, 2021, are much lower for our revenue box because of the pandemic that has occurred. Below that, you'll see our Fairbox recovery rate, which is basically a ratio of revenue to the total budget to give an idea of what portion of the budget is paid for by revenue of the system. You can see that it was 36% in 19, and roughly that's the rough level proposed in the governor's budget. Again, those rates of 48, 47 in the 2020 and 2021 are much lower than that. Those were the authorized levels, but we realized much less. I think we have a slide that shows that coming up. The funding source breakout down below gives our, you can see the makeup of our budget, and the primary thing I guess I would show is that our operating budget compared to FY 2022, if you exclude the forward funding amount, it basically has increased $23 million over the budget proposed last year or implemented last year. There's a lot of other numbers on there I could speak to if there's questions.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I don't know if this is further on in the presentation. Is there something that lists actual weeks of service?
I think so, yes, Madam Chair.
So that's further on in the presentation.
Let's take a look. I think so. Next slide. I can't recall.
Moving on.
I'll let maybe I could just jump forward to this slide. This is our weeks of service that we're. This shows the revenues collected along with the actual weeks of service. So I knew it was in there. I just didn't recall where.
For those watching at home, we're on page 27, or slide 27. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you'll see, the big glaring thing is the FY20 and 21. Our revenues were projected around 40 something million, and we collected around, upper 28, $27 million. And our weeks of service were 203 weeks and 200 weeks. And 2022, we're looking at a projection of 224 weeks and $41 million of revenue. And if I could revert back, we can kind of see that we were significantly under what under what we had planned for.
Representative Rasmussen. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess I'm just curious how much was the pandemic in the planned weeks of service, and what role the mechanical issues with many of the vessels played in that. And I mean, I can only see back from 2019 here, so it would be helpful if we could have a farther look back for what was authorized, you know, back to maybe 2014, since we have the actuals, and see the comparison year to year of how much was planned and how much we were actually able to execute for trips or services.
Well, so I know we have another slide on some history, but I'm not sure it'll answer your question. We'll get back to you if it doesn't.
I think you could please continue.
All right, I'm going to turn this one over to Dom. This is his good work here.
Tom Pannone, Department of Transportation. So this slide is just to, some of you may have seen this before, but it's to provide a illustration of where we're talking about in time and what funds went to getting us into the forward funded scenario. So looking at the graphic on the bottom, there's four rows there, the numbers are on the left. Row four shows us the months, calendar years, and fiscal years, and it shows where we're at today on the yellow second regular session. Going up to row three, that shows in the green appropriations there, that's the 6-month appropriations and the 12-month appropriations that we received for the current year's budget. And those fund sources are outlined in the table above, the green table. So continuing down row three, you'll see the requested funding for 12 months, about $142 million. That would start January 1st, calendar year 2023. So that's the period of time we're talking about with the governor's budget request. Looking at row two and row one, that just shows where in time our operating schedules are that we release and when we release those. So from October to October to the end of September is a winter summer schedule. And we used to carve those out into two separate schedules and didn't release the whole year at once. So you can see then at row one, when we released that first full year schedule in August of 2021, and then when we anticipate to release the next full year schedule.
Thank you, Representative Edgman.
Yes, so how does the Marine Highway Replacement Fund, which I think was capitalized about $20 million and is swept, if I have that correct, how does that play into this picture?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman. So the Vessel Replacement Fund, the unobligated balances were swept. The Vessel Replacement Fund is largely for capital. So that doesn't play into our operating or this picture necessarily, but the $22 million of match that was for the Tustamina replacement vessel, that remains in there. But otherwise, it doesn't really affect our operating budget too much.
Follow up?
And so we would see in the capital budget then a commensurate amount for the Marine Highway Replacement Fund or not?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, certainly the amount that was swept from the department perspective was unappropriated and is gone. So there's no proposal at this point in time to for the legislature to reappropriate those funds into the Vessel Replacement Fund.
Yes, Representative Edgman.
So is there the opportunity through the incoming federal money to recapitalize that and perhaps recapitalize it at a much greater amount?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, so certainly the Marine Highway System Fund balance will grow as we're not expending the revenues collected to operate the system. So it does create an opportunity, an uncertain opportunity, but the balance of the Marine Highway System does accumulate.
My last question.
Yes, follow up?
And this one I don't think you can respond to, but I'll just put it out there anyway. Is, you know, in terms of aviation, we have the Central Air Service program, and it benefits Southeast Alaska, goes out to ADAC, a few other communities around the state. but from your initial read of the infrastructure money, with a great emphasis on marine highway system, including the word operational that's put into the budget, that means that you can use some of that money not just for capital, but you can use it for the operations, as we've seen time and again in the budget process. But have you been able to analyze the bill enough you know, there's been discussions about the increasing costs of ferry service, and in my neck of the woods in Southwest, the ferry is used to haul big ticket items all the way down the chain, cars, nets, building supplies, whatever it might be. But is there any opportunity to create an essential air service type leveling off of fares for the Marine Highway System?
Madam Chair, Rob Carpenter, DOT. Representative Edgman, I think you said it right. We don't necessarily can't answer that. I think the intent of the $200 million annually in the rural ferry program, operations program, was sort of to provide an essential service to rural communities, a ferry service. How it's structured after that, I think, is up to the legislature and the administration to work it out.
But and just one last.
Yes. Representative.
Again, relying on your initial read, and I think we're all beginning to get more and more informed about the bill itself and some of the programmatic aspects of it. That's not precluded to have that type of a central air service arrangement for ferry system, as best as you can tell, because I've looked at some of the language, and maybe that means I know less than others, but I didn't see that that language kind of barring something like that.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, to my knowledge, that wouldn't a service like that would not be precluded. No.
Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Just a comment for Representative Edgman, and he made me reflect on the sweep of the Marine Highway vessel replacement. Maybe these gentlemen know, but I think in the main Supreme Court decision on sweepability, Hickel v. Cooper, federal monies are not sweepable. So it could be that if monies were restored to that account, they would not be vulnerable to a sweep this summer. And it may be something for us to think about. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Getting back to the $135 million, almost $136 million being dedicated towards operations, it would be IJA money. You spoke about how the bill itself calls for $200 million annually going to marine operations. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but basically intended for marine operations, similar to the kind that we have here in Alaska. So do we expect that even though we're budgeting $135 million of IJA money, that we very well may receive more than the $135 million?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we're very hopeful. As Dom mentioned earlier, the competition for this money is pretty limited. It seems almost written for Alaska. There's not a lot of other rural programs with ports 50 miles apart, and I think it's population inclusion as well. So we believe we're going to get a substantial portion, I don't want to say all of it, but most of this money annually.
Was Maine one of the other states?
Madam Chair, we had, I think, initially thought Maine might be, but I'm not even sure they are anymore. There's some territories, I think, that were identified, but we're not sure territories qualify, so.
Representative Ortiz.
And in relationship to that same topic, if, let's say it's only $140 million, which is a significant amount of money that we receive, but if it were something like that, how much consideration was given to the issue of the aging fleet and basically saying, well, maybe why not have a little less weeks of service and maybe not go for the full weeks of service, but then trade that off for more money being left over for actual capital expenditure? And I understand that earlier in your presentation, you're not even sure definitively whether capital expenditures can be used. these funds can be used for capital expenditure. But if they were, was there any consideration, or will you think there be future consideration to really addressing the fleet issues? Because ultimately, to me, that's the fundamental problem that we have here. And so that's just, I guess, a kind of a question.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I mean, you're on point. You know, this money came out not that long ago, and it's a nice surprise, and it's a good problem to have, is how to utilize it. We certainly are cognitive of the aging fleet. We're just proceeded toward with the Testamina replacement vessel. We're working on the versatility of our fleet with adding the crew quarters to the Hubbard, and the new board, it will certainly, it's their number one priority as of, you know, we polled the board before the meeting, and the discussion at the primary meeting, the aging fleet is the priority and will certainly be on everybody's mind going forward. We're more than willing to work with the legislature on how this, you know, how the money gets programmed, whether it's operating or capital or whatever the will of everyone is. There's certainly the need there for both. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
All right. This is pretty. Maybe you guys have seen this one. It's one of my favorite slides, it shows. Back to 1992 in real dollars, adjusted into 2021 dollars, the generated revenue and other fund sources that make up the budget. And other fund sources includes any general funds that we just lumped it into two categories. So the salmon colored bar is generated revenue, and the blue portion represents the other fund sources, primarily going to be unrestricted general funds that are appropriated by the legislature. And it gives a picture of the total budget over this time period. And then the yellow gold line is the farebox recovery rate. So it's showing what portion of the budget was basically covered by the revenues of the system. And it's kind of interesting. You'll see in the middle there the spikes in the budget and then the drop in the later years here. And this is, I believe, actuals, correct, Don? Yeah, so these are actual numbers, not our budgeted numbers. But what's one takeaway is in the last few years, you can see that, in 2022, we had entirely funded the budget with federal money, and we put off to the side the little salmon-colored revenue bar. We still are collecting the money. It's just not in the budget, so we're not expending it. And you can see that again in the governor's 2023 proposed budget, where there's a tiny bit of revenue in there for ineligible expenses, and then majority of the budget's proposed using federal money. But you know, I guess the takeaway, I'm not sure what it is. It's just an interesting look back, showing that revenue has historically been a higher portion of the budget, at least on a inflation-adjusted basis, and we're certainly trying to recover a little bit more into the 30s, which is the historical norm in the future.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, also interesting, just going back in the time, because I chaired this budget subcommittee a few years ago, and I remember at that time that the Boston Highway System comprised about 45% all UGF going into the Department of Transportation, 45%, nearly half.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to have that juxtaposition of those numbers, because I think the efforts clearly have been made to reduce that 45% number down, and I'm sure it is, and maybe you can, verify that. But the issue of the Marine Highway System has always been an issue. I remember back in the early 90s being in this building, the same sort of outcry that the Marine Highway System needed to be, fundamentally restructured. But I think there's good efforts underway, and it would be just interesting to point that out, because it is a big chunk of the department's, unrestricted general fund money.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Edgman, my former job, I do recall a graph where it was the general fund, the unrestricted general funds going to the to Marine Highway and our Highways and Aviation, which is all our M&O maintenance and operations of the highways. And both of them plummeting, you know, and during all these tough budget times, and then meeting at basically equal at some point really recently. And so, yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Just very quickly, I have to chuckle because Mr. Carpenter might have been the source of those numbers.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair, I think we covered this one. Any questions on? Oh, okay. This is just this slide on slide 28 is a quick snapshot of our historical overhaul appropriation we get in the capital budget, which is this is the money we use for our annual recertifications for the vessels for them to run. We get approved by the Coast Guard and American Bureau of Shipping. So they're approved to run safely, and it's an annual, like I said, every ship goes into overhaul every year. There's a portion where they're out of service and they're in dry dock and getting work done. It's typically been, you can see the ranges in from 15 to 20 or 19 to so million dollars. We have a budget request in this year for 20 million just because of you can see the last few years it's been in that range, and the maintenance issues are certainly not decreasing.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm just curious, it looks like in fiscal year 19, we only had one vessel that I'm assuming was taken out of service, and in 21, we're looking at four, if I'm reading this correctly. Is that, I'm assuming if it's a dash, it means that we're not putting any money into it because we're not operating that vessel.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, astute observation. You're right that the four vessels with the dash are all, other than the Malaspina, they've been sold. So we sold the Chiniga and the Fairweather. Those were our fast vehicle ferries. We just closed the sale on those last year. The Taku was sold several years ago, and the Malaspina is in the process of disposal.
Just a quick follow-up. So I guess I'm curious how we're going to meet the weeks of service that was projected with three fewer vessels than we did in 19. How does the department plan on meeting those weeks of service at the same levels as 19 with three fewer vessels?
Through the chair, good question. Dom, can you speak to that, or maybe Matt?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. So we do have the Teslina and Hubbard, which are relatively newer ships. And the other ships were out of service for, I think, out of service before fiscal year 19. So I don't think there's an impact there. And Matt McLaren, perhaps we could allow him to comment.
Mr. McLaren?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. Mr. Pannone is correct. We do have the Hubbard and Teslina added into service, so that helps our weeks of service come back. And back when we had more of those ships running, like we had the Fairweather, Chiniga, and the Taku, we were running at that time around FY15, FY16, we were running over 400 weeks of service, and we're coming back now with the governor's proposed budget, but not quite up to that level. But certainly the net effect of where we're at now, we'll have 10 ships that will be operating at times during the year as opposed to 11. So we're essentially only down one ship from those past years.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next slide gets into our staffing, our crew staffing shortage. I think Representative Carpenter had mentioned, you know, what's the impact or why are we losing people? I know we have this breakout for Marine Highway. We don't really have it for the M&O side, but as you can see here, the graphic off to the left shows our, for the last 3 years, it was broken into the total amount hired each year versus the total amount resigned, retired, and or terminated. So there's obviously a discrepancy in our hiring effort versus losing people. And so that's created a significant shortfall. You can see up in the upper right quadrant or section there, that table shows the amount of positions we have vacant by position type. The largest being our entry-level stewards at 255 positions, or 71% of that classification. On down, you can see wipers, engineers, et cetera, in the vacancies in those areas.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was just curious what state requirements have come in place, or I don't know if it's regulatory or statute, but it's my understanding after touring one of the vessels this summer, basically you used to have your entry-level people start working, and then they were able to earn the certifications that they needed to be on the boat. I'm not sure if all of the change was federal for them to be able to be on the vessel and working, or if some of that is state for safety stuff.
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I don't believe the state's implemented any new requirements. Matt, can you add some light to any of that there might be additional federal or other?
Mr. McLaren?
Yeah, through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen, there are, depending on the ship, there are certain federal requirements we have, like the Kennecott, for example. There's a STCW requirement for that ship, but there, I don't know of any new, essentially, requirements. We try to have all the crews trained before they get on the ship, at least basic safety training, so we can operate safely. So they're trained. They need to know how to evacuate the ship safely. We've had a lot of, with the turnover that we've had and a lot of crews that we've left, we certainly have lost a lot of that experience, and we've been short-staffed shoreside as well. So that's impacted a little bit of our training process, but we're starting to work through those now and get those crews trained back, and so that, you know, we certainly don't want to send them out working on the ship unless they're trained and ready to go, and the Coast Guard wouldn't allow it either. So
follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess the only other question I had is, as the state's going through the collective bargaining process, are we working with the unions at all on scheduling? Because it was my understanding that there was some issue between the unions and the state on how they're able to schedule, and one thing that the state could do is allow the unions to kind of take over on the scheduling for their members, to just create a better situation, I guess, for employees and less overtime.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I think you're thinking of dispatch, the union dispatch potentially. I can't really speak to that. I know we're working on some things with the unions right now. We'd like a few of the things changed just so we can manage the system better. But I'm not aware of that issue that we're specifically discussing.
Just FYI, co-chair is stepping out. I need to step out at 3:30. We lost our other vice chair here, so unless our other ranking member of finance would like to take the gavel, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. So I was looking at the vacancies. I was just wondering where you advertise those at. Are they advertised on Workplace Alaska? I mean, I haven't seen them out there. How do you recruit and find people for these positions?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, we are aggressively recruiting right now. They're on Workplace Alaska. We're working with the Department of Labor. We have advertisements in all local news, all social media. We have it on our website, and a few other ways that we've been. It's been something we're very aggressively recruiting for right now.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, this slide's just kind of wrapping up the staffing. We wanted to show to set an expectation we're trying to of the crewing we need to acquire, I guess, to run ships this summer. So our main fleet to run Aurora, Matanuska, Lekani, Latuya, Kennecott, and the Testamina, we figure we need about 24 positions. I'm not sure exactly which positions those are, but that's the they have a count on that. And then what we're doing here is to try and show how many more positions we need to fill to run the rest of these vessels. So in theory, adding the Taslina would be another 44 positions we need to run that vessel this summer. So basically we'd need a total of 68. And then if we wanted to run the Columbia like we plan to, we'll need a total of 125. So the difference between 68 and 125 is 52 times 2 is 101 to run the Columbia. And then to run both Taslina and Columbia, we need a total of 166. And the real challenge is we need these positions by March 1st in order to get them all properly trained and certified to have an operation, like, for example, the Columbia operational by May 1st. Not painting the best picture.
Representative Rasmussen.
Sorry, I'll be brief. I'm just curious, can we get a scenario of how the weeks of service would be impacted if we don't meet these staffing requirements? Because, I mean, it's a couple weeks out. It seems like we're starting to get a little desperate on the timeline.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, fair question. We can certainly look at if we, for example, can't crew the Columbia, what that does.
Please continue. I love it. Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the informative presentation. But I wanted to go back to airport operations, particularly in rural Alaska. I believe there was a comment made about in some parts of the state it's on private contract for airport maintenance. Is that basically runway maintenance? And I'm just wondering how common is that? Which airports are under private contract? How long has that been in place with the different airports? And I would just be curious to see the nature of the agreement. Is it possible to look at one of the contracts? And is it at all common where some of these contract holders are private businesses that employ union labor? I'm just curious about those types of issues. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we happen to have the Deputy Commissioner for Aviation here, and he could really address that if you'd be open to it.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, John Binder, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. Through the Chair, Representative LeBond. Yes, it's a huge tool in our toolbox there for managing our rural airports. We've had this system in place for a lot of years. Really, the way we decide whether we contract out the maintenance at a location versus doing in-house with the DOT staff depends on what type of airport it is. Generally, when you think of our hub-type airports, they have a much higher certification requirement under the FAA, so a lot more skill set required. So those we operate with DOT staff that we can make sure we keep trained up and provide all the services needed at those airports. Once you get outside of those hubs, kind of the spokes or the villages surrounding those, operations requirements go way down and the certification and the necessary compliance issues go down as well. So it really just comes down to maintaining the surface of the runway, whether it's keeping snow clear, gravel smooth, et cetera. So those are the ones where we contract out to a local villager, if you will, somebody located in the community there that can maintain that. We do provide the equipment and the storage for that facility and basically just pay for the labor associated with that. So as referenced earlier, we're not providing retirement benefits or any of those kind of things along with that. So it ends up being a much cheaper method for maintaining that runway than putting the DOT individual out there year-round. We certainly have copies of those contracts. We'd be happy to provide it for you. Typically, those are 1 or 2 year contracts with a couple of years extension opportunities for us as well.
Follow-up?
I may, Mr. Vice Chair. Yes, and just off the top of your head, are any of those contracts with union employed businesses, or are they all non-union, or does it vary, or what would be your comment about that?
Through the chair, Representative Lamont, just off the top of my head, I think very few of them are unionized in general. In a lot of cases, it's a single individual who's just maintained that for years and just has a business license.
Yes, final comment, Mr. Vice Chair. Just be interesting to see a list of the airports, how long the agreements have been in place, and if you have a sample contract or two, I know I'd be interested in seeing one of them. Thank you.
Absolutely. We'd be happy to provide that.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Out of curiosity, a few years ago, I think there was a problem with it snowed. The driver is going to come to the airport to clean the runway, and he plows the road on the road to the runway or the airport. And then there was some problems in there with certain things where you couldn't have that guy clean the runway. I don't remember what those parameters were or the why fors, but there was some reasoning in there that you couldn't use that same guy. I don't remember what that was, but it's something I wouldn't mind reflecting back on.
Through Chair, Representative Thompson, I guess I would need more details on where and when that was. The real issues we get to typically on somebody not being able to do highway versus airport comes down to how the equipment was purchased, and the FAA has very strict requirements on FAA-purchased equipment may not leave the airport, except for very dire emergency-type situations. So it's usually the equipment versus the person.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, and appreciate it through the chair. Back to the Malaspina issue, the cost that we've thrown around here and in subcommittee is $30,000 to $35,000 for the mooring or storage of the vessel. Is that an all-in cost, or are there other costs associated with the vessel now, such as insurance or our labor costs, or what's the all-in cost, and how do you break that down?
Mr. Chairman, Rob Carpenter, DOT. I think it's all in. I'm not sure about the risk management part. I know we insure our boats kind of together, so in a pool, but $30,000 is for, you know, security, utilities, everything, running the lines. And I could ask if Matt McLaren might have more clarification if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Matt?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that cost is the mooring, utilities, electricity. That's for the cost of it sitting where it's at. It does not include risk management, but we can get you the breakdown for that ship. We have lowered the cost of risk management. We work closely with the risk management group in the last couple months and lowered that amount because they determined we don't need to cover it for as much as we previously thought we had, but we can get you the breakdown of what that's costing for the risk management portion, too.
I think that would be helpful. Thank you. And one follow-up?
Follow-up.
On a completely different subject, how many collective bargaining contracts do we have that are under contract negotiations right now, if any?
Sure. Rob Carpenter, DOT. Are we specifically talking to the Marine Highway System?
Yes.
Under contract, oh, geez. I know all three were up for were negotiating, and I don't think we've settled any other than maybe a rollover while we continue negotiations. I think that's the case, but we'll get back to you for sure.
One follow-up. When did negotiations begin on those contracts?
Recently. Okay, we'll provide you more detail. Representative.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. My only remaining question is, way back at page 7, you noted motor fuel tax receipts of $36 million. And, of course, in 2019, we had the closure of the Silvertip Maintenance Station. How are motor fuel tax receipts holding on now? Are they, is the trend line up or down on them?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that question largely would be better answered by Department of Revenue as they do that kind of analysis. We don't typically do that, but we are looking at making sure that those revenues will be enough to fund our current budget.
Follow up?
Follow up is can what flexibility does the department have to take from some source other than that to do maintenance of or to fund maintenance stations? Is it restricted just to that source?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So, our funding of maintenance stations was done with the reopening of the three maintenance stations, Silvertip, Birch Lake, and Chitna, was done with federal highways dollars. So we're not limited to the type of dollars we can use to open the maintenance stations, and motor fuel tax isn't limited to any specific use. It's you can be appropriated by the legislature for whatever they see fit.
Okay, seeing no additional questions, that concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 15th at 1:30 p.m., where we will be hearing from the Department of Transportation again and on Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or otherwise known as the STIP, and the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act funding. And with that, we are adjourned at approximately 3:40 p.m.